Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. My guest for this episode is Chris Schaberg. You might remember him from the episode I did on SUV commercials. He's a professor of English at Loyola University in New Orleans. And as much fun as I had talking to him about car commercials that feature large tracts of wilderness and no other cars, his real specialty is airplanes, or rather, air travel. He's written several books on the topic, including The Textual Life of Airports, The End of Airports, Airportness, and Grounded, his musings on how the shutdown of 2020 affected air travel and our perspective on it. Most of us who are concerned about climate change know that air travel is a contributor to global warming, one that we may not like to think about because, for now at least, there's no real solution to the carbon emissions and other impacts of air travel. And the idea of not flying at all is hard for some of us to imagine. Though some climate activists, including famously Greta Thunberg, have decided simply not to fly anymore. But Schaberg isn't just focused on the practical side of whether or not or how much we choose to fly. He's interested in what this vast network of travel reveals about the world we live in and how we relate to it. We also decide to talk about the film Don't Look Up that came out in December. Okay, it was my idea. The director, Adam McKay, has said that the film, about a comet that is hurtling towards Earth and threatens to annihilate all life on the planet, is an allegory for climate change. Critics were divided on the film. Some touted it as a climate change Dr. Strangelove, while others criticized it as smug, not funny, or not a good analogy for climate change. It seemed like it needed to be discussed. But first, I talked to Chris about how he became interested in airports and air travel in the first place. By the way, if I sound a little punchy at times, it's because the pandemic has been going on for, you know, forever. And as it happens, I had just come off of 10 days of fever due to COVID. So bear with me.
I think it was March or April 2001. I started working at a small airport outside of Bozeman, Montana. It was just like, you know, the part-time job to pay the bills. It was a weird, interesting job. One of those jobs where, you know, you learn kind of every part of the job, every part of the airport operations. But then 9/11 happened, like 6 months after. And so working at an airport for a United Airlines contractor, seeing all those changes happen, I think, looking back, had a pretty profound impact on me. It was also noteworthy that I was working at this little airport in beautiful Bozeman, Montana. And so I was always thinking about the kind of odd juxtapositions between the built space of the airport and the mountains just beyond the airfield. Because I was, at that point, working on my master's writing about environmental aesthetics. So, yeah, but I wasn't really thinking about it as an intellectual topic until several years later when I was at UC Davis and I started working on a dissertation on airports in American literature and culture. So that was kind of the early trajectory of that interest. Of course, I feel like a total charlatan now because I haven't flown in almost 2 years and I'm very detached from what's been happening at airports and around air travel, even though I still follow it, armchair.
Yeah. Well, I mean, being an armchair flyer, I feel like is part of the experience right now, right?
Yeah, you're right.
I travel by watching TV,
right?
Basically at this point.
Yeah.
I like in your, one of the things that characterizes your writing style, which I enjoy, is how you thread together your own personal experiences with these much broader interrogations, particularly in your book on the Anthropocene. And you also mentioned you teach a class on airports and air travel and how you encourage your students to bring their own experiences to bear. So I'm curious what your experience has been with that in terms of your students and that intersection between our personal experiences and these much broader trends that you're trying to kind of tease out.
I think I first taught an airport seminar here at Loyola University New Orleans, almost on a lark. Maybe the honors program asked me to teach one of their interdisciplinary honors seminars. And I thought, oh, I'll do one on airports because I'd, you know, had been writing on them. But what I found was that the students were so excited to share their experiences and coming from different disciplines really helped. I would get anywhere from students who'd never traveled, you know, they're from maybe rural Louisiana and they've never flown. And then I would get international students who flew all the time, or students from military backgrounds who traveled internationally because of their parents. And so bringing those students together and hearing them exchange stories and realize that they were, you know, part of this kind of collective activity, air travel. It's like air travel sold as an individual activity. But I think part of the lesson in that class is everyone becoming aware that this is this vast collective species being thing that we're involved in. And so teaching the topic of air travel really led me to think about it in new ways and write about it in new ways. And I think write about it in more personal ways as I've gone on, like you mentioned with the Anthropocene book, that has more of my own stories in it. And I think that came from those classes.
Okay, so let's talk a little. First of all, airports are just these weird spaces, right? We all have these narratives, whether they're personal narratives or movie narratives or things like that associated with airports. You know, the rom-com where somebody runs to the airport to stop somebody before they get onto the plane. And yet at the same time, there's sort of these spaces that take us outside of our ordinary existence. So you're the expert on this. Like how have you come to think about airports as a kind of unique space or maybe a more of an emblematic space in some ways?
Well, I mean, I'm just pausing to think about this because it's really, I guess I haven't really articulated this yet, but I feel like obviously the spaces of airports have changed a lot over the last couple of years with the pandemic. I mean, if you look back at travel in, let's say, like December 2019, like I was looking at some pictures that I took when I was flying through the Atlanta airport in December 2018. It's like, oh my God, look at us. Look at just these seething, grotesque bodies crammed into these spaces. And now airports are these, you know, heightened, sensitized spaces where masking and airflow and everything is kind of under high scrutiny. So there's been a change that I haven't quite found a way to talk about yet. But I mean, for a long time, the French anthropologist Marc Auger called them airports non-places. And so from a kind of critical anthropological perspective, they were thought of as emblematic of these spaces of supermodernity that were in between other spaces. And I always thought about that from an ecological register as, oh, airports are liminal zones or even ecotones for our species. They're somewhere that we always only pass through. We're not really meant to stay there. And there are all these kind of indicator species of like what's happening in broader cultural networks. I mean, I guess that's why like right now, what's interesting to me is that airports have become these contested sites for things like masking or vaccine mandates. And we see a lot more air rage and fights happening in airplanes and airports over these issues. Well, that's an indicator of these broader cultural tensions, but the airport somehow pressurizes the social space and allows these outbursts to happen.
Going back to the Anthropocene book, so you talk about, at one point you say the airport is the beating heart of the Anthropocene. Can you kind of unpack that for us? Because I feel like that intersection is important.
I was thinking about like route maps, you know, and thinking about those stripes around the globe. I mean, there are all sorts of forms of travel that contribute to what we think of as the Anthropocene and carbon expenditure. But air travel seems to be at once the most kind of covering of the globe and yet also the most kind of weirdly invisible. You know, I mean, you might hear when a jet passes overhead at 30,000 feet, but we often don't think of this like pulsing network of these machines that are happening 24 hours a day, interlacing the globe. And so I think that's what I meant. It's kind of an audacious thing to say, I guess, so that the beating heart of the Anthropocene or whatever. But I think that's what I was getting at.
I mean, I think if we talk about COVID a little bit, that might get us closer also to what you were talking about. You have this book called Grounded, in which you talk about flight during the pandemic, and the pandemic in some ways sort of pulls back the curtain on certain aspects of flight, right?
Absolutely.
Most obviously the fact that these pathogens can be carried very quickly around the world to international flight.
And it was amazing to me how early on, you know, airlines sort of, you know, conducted their own studies to prove that, like, look, the airplanes are safe, like the filters are good. It's actually really hard for the virus to spread on the airplane. But what was elided by these studies was like, Actually, that's precisely how the virus spread so quickly around the globe, was through air travel.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about like isolating one specific, you know, cabin of an airliner and proving that it's relatively safe to fly one trip. It's thinking, you know, globally about the whole network.
Right. Even if you don't catch COVID on the airplane, the person who's bringing COVID is going to distribute it pretty quickly.
Right. And I guess it does become kind of allegorical for the ways that airplanes, you know, contribute to this larger epoch.
So since climate change looms over all of this, I feel like we need to talk a little bit about the environmental cost of flying. So I did a little bit of research on that. Do you want to speak to that, sort of what the carbon emissions are and the other environmental fallout of air travel?
I mean, I'd really love to hear what you find out.
I'll read a little bit. You know, so I found that in terms of CO2 emissions, there were different statistics. So here's from a BBC article. It says around 2.4 of global CO2 emissions come from aviation. Together with other gases and the water vapor trails produced by aircraft, the industry is responsible for about 5% of global warming. So that in and of itself may make it seem not so terrible. I don't know, on a certain level. But the individual cost of flying is significant. So here's a statistic they give. A return flight from London to San Francisco. This is the BBC. I'm pretending we're British. Emits around 5.5 tons of CO2 equivalent per person, more than twice the emissions produced by a family car in a year, and about half of the average carbon footprint of someone living in Britain. Probably less of the carbon footprint of somebody living in the U.S. But still, that's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. I have some other sites that I pulled as well. 2.4 is another statistic of the total CO2 emissions in 2018, although that doesn't account for all of the global warming effects, because it's not just the CO2 that airplanes are producing, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's complicated in that sense, because there are all sorts of different ways of measuring the impact, but also this awareness that it can be measured in different ways, that it can be measured relative to other industries, but it can also be measured in terms of individual carbon mm-hmm. footprint. And in that sense, it's quite dramatic.
Yeah. And it's one of these collective pursuits that becomes really hard to talk about in terms of like, how do you bridge that gap between like your own contributions to it and whatever the larger cumulative effects are. I mean, I guess it's sort of like what, you know, air travel is, what, you know, Timothy Morton would call a hyper object. It exceeds our ability to kind of like grasp it as a totality, even as it has this total effect on the globe. It also really keeps us from asking like, well, what pragmatically, how would we think about this differently? How would we reconceptualize travel or reinvent travel? You know, I feel like that's a real missed opportunity, the pandemic. Like, instead of saying, whoa, let's use these probably 3 years of disruption to reinvent how we travel in the US. Instead, it's like, let's just keep it propped up and keep it going as much as possible and try to get back to normal. It's like, wow, that was a real missed opportunity.
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel like the pandemic really opened up new ways of thinking, of traveling more locally, for instance.
Exactly.
You know, and also of just maybe not thinking always in absolutes. I mean, some people have decided not to fly anymore. Mm-hmm. Some people have decided just to half the amount of flights that they take, for instance. Because one of the problems with the carbon emissions is the increase in air travel. So, you know, like every aspect of capitalism, this industry is based on, you know, constant
growth.
Constant growth. So in 1960, 100 million passengers traveled by air. In 2007, the total annual worldwide passenger count was 4 billion. And there's constant projected growth. So, you know, so what happens if we think of ways to decrease that? And then I feel like you butt up against the monster of capitalism, right? Because we're so taught to believe that that
is the only way.
Means like that any decrease would be defeat. And
Right. No, that's exactly right. I would often look at that based on like how aircraft manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus, would, you know, how they were projecting out their sales. On the one hand, they would say, like, our new aircraft are, you know, 10% more fuel efficient. But on the other hand, we expect to be selling thousands more of these aircraft every year, or whatever the numbers are. And so it's just like, oh, well, there's a kind of contradiction there. There's not really a commitment to becoming more fuel efficient if the overall idea is more airplanes in the air as much as possible.
And I feel like air travel also, you come up against the limitations of a technological solution to climate change, right? I'm sure you know more than I do about what kind of technological innovations have been proposed, but it does seem, at least at this point, that there's kind of no silver bullet to the problem of carbon emissions when it comes to air travel. And so it forces us to either ignore the problem or reconsider our behaviors, you know?
Yeah.
Our ways of being.
I had an environmental humanities seminar last semester, and we talked about this several times because I had a couple students who had obviously been sort of enlightened or had their worlds opened up by traveling to certain remote places around the world and learning to care more. And some of these students became like environmental studies majors. And so it was precisely traveling to some of these geographies that led them to want to care more about it. And so we talked about like, well, what is the like tricky calculus there between, you know, encouraging travel if we think it's going to result in traveling less, as it were, you know, caring more for, as you say, like the local or localities everywhere. That's something that, you know, again, there's not like a one size fits all solution there, but it is something that I've kind of come up against in a few times recently. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you were saying too, about like, what do we do with our own like identity formations or attachments to places in other parts of the world where we do want to be able to visit home, you know, once a year or once every other year? How do we do that or justify that without just sort of, you know, opening the floodgates to travel anywhere, anytime at the cheapest airfare?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are international creatures at this point. So what do we do about that? And
right.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to.
Yeah. One of my favorite books that I cite several times at the end of that, Searching for the Anthropocene, is Bruno Latour's book, Down to Earth, which is short and really just like punchy and direct with a kind of call to rethinking our planetary being.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. So I'm sort of tempted to talk about the movie and then maybe we can cycle back.
Yeah.
Okay, spoiler alert. We're going to be talking about the film from the beginning to the end. So if you haven't yet seen it, you've been warned. And if you need a reminder, Don't Look Up is a dark comedy written and directed by Adam McKay about an astronomy graduate student named Kate Dibioski and her professor, Dr. Randall Mindy, who discover that a planet-killer comet is making a beeline for the Earth. It will collide in 6 months and kill all living beings on Earth if something isn't done to destroy it first. Dibioski and Mindy, played by Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, go to the president and then the media to try to sound the alarm. But various problems stymie their efforts, from a Trump-like president played by Meryl Streep to a collective denialism reminiscent of the recent efforts we've seen to discredit the COVID vaccine. In the end, it does not go well, and there's a definite shift in tone in the film from parody to something like eulogy as we approach the apocalyptic ending.
You know, we were talking about the fact that we're international creatures, that we're global creatures, and how much that space view of Earth really characterizes who we are. And mm-hmm. So one of the things I thought was interesting about Don't Look Up was, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of the fact that an asteroid is not really a good analogy for climate change. Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like that's kind of missing the point a little bit because it's a farce, you know, a right. satire. But I think it's interesting that the metaphor is a space rock because it forces us to think about the Earth as a planet and to think of our position in space, which so much shapes our worldview. It's kind of an indirect way.
No, I mean,
a topic, but
I think that's right. I think it's also, I mean, another link that we hit on earlier was that the kind of technological or the kind of futurist ways that humans imagine that they can fix climate change or escape. And I think it's also important that it was an asteroid because it let the film entertain the kind of Elon Musk fantasy of, you know, going elsewhere, escaping mm-hmm. in order to preserve the species. You know, that I think is really importantly tied to how we think about climate change in a really mundane way, because that is happening. That was not farce at all. All that kind of outer space imaginary was actually like coldly realistic in mm-hmm. a lot of ways mm-hmm. in terms of what some technologists and futurists want to happen and are actually like right now, as we speak, they are working on making the rocket that will take us to Mars.
Yeah. Instance.
And so I thought that was a really important part of the film that the asteroid let them kind of cash out.
Yeah. That was interesting. I actually, when I rewatched it, I finished watching the rest of the credits. I hadn't seen the first time around that last little bit. But so did you like the movie overall? Let's just start from there.
I really liked it, the beginning of it. And I ended up feeling like I wish they would have just stretched out for another hour, which would have made it not really a great Hollywood, film. But it felt like there was so much they wanted to do and it felt very rushed toward the end. Which, you know, goes with the urgency of the film by the end. But I felt like some of the threads could have been teased out a little bit more. So, you know, by that point, I'm like kind of committed to some of these characters. And I wanted to tarry with them a bit longer, if that makes sense. Even if we ended up with the same ending.
I personally found it pretty effective. And it definitely rattled me, which surprised me in a way. The fact that they didn't pull their punches at all at the end. And for me, it was in a way really about the end, about the fact that you see the annihilation of the earth.
Right. But in that respect, I honestly, you know, will say that I know it's not really fair to compare films, but like I really preferred Melancholia.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh yeah. Please see that. Cause that is another film that has like imminent planetary destruction and very much, you know, results in that. And it's weird and surrealist and slow. I mean, it's a different mood, very different kind of film, but with a similar ending.
I mean, in some ways, what I found most interesting about Don't Look Up was the blowback, the criticism. It felt like it made people uncomfortable. One of the criticisms was about how it doesn't really work as an analogy for climate change, which is true, of course, right? It was a much simpler threat, but to me, it just seemed like the film required that in a way in order to be able to highlight the things that it did, you know.
Yeah.
The denialism, really.
Right. Denialism. Yeah. And the just kind of inertia and the refusal to actually do something.
Right.
Look up, make a change. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think part of the reason that I had less trouble with the climate change analogy is that I've started to look at like so many films seem like they're about climate change to me. Almost like I start watching a movie and it's going to be about climate change in some way or another, you know, like if it has any kind of futuristic, let alone like a apocalyptic kind of resonance to it, it seems like it's dealing with it in some way or another. I think like what was different about this film, not exclusively, but is that it was self-consciously about climate change, you know?
Yeah. You know, I'm a little ashamed to admit this, but I recently watched the newest James Bond film, No Time to Die. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that yet either.
I mean, okay, that's for another episode.
I'm sure lots of material, though.
But it's weird now that you mention this. It has an apocalyptic ending. It is, in a weird way, about climate change, I think. And, you know, it's the film that was like, it was delayed several times throughout the pandemic. And I was sort of like, why do they keep delaying this film? Well, partly it's because it's about a weaponized biological agent, nanobots, like virus things. And I was like, oh, well, there we go. But in a weird way, now that we're talking about Don't Look Up, it was kind of nagging at me like, what was interesting about that movie? Why did I want to see it? And why did I want to keep watching it? Because in some ways, it's just like another Bond film. But it too is a weird kind of climate change parable.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but I'll
I mean, I feel like it's all over the place, really. But you know, I maybe I'm it's partly the way that I'm seeing the world, but So going back a little bit to the airplane stuff, one of the things I found interesting aesthetically about Don't Look Up was the way that it juxtaposes and contrasts things that are meant to feel kind of analog, for lack of a better word, with technology. So the very opening shots of the film, for instance, you see Jennifer Lawrence, what's her character's name again?
DiBiase.
You see her sweater. She's got this fuzzy sweater. You see her drinking some herbal tea. There are all these things that feel very like homey, kind of earthbound, human in a sort of biological sense. And then you zoom up to the telescope, which is this massive telescope. In the beginning, I almost thought it might be some kind of futuristic story. I didn't know that much about it because the telescope itself is just this like crazy technological space, kind of not unlike certain very modern airports, right? But that contrast is there, I feel like, from the very beginning of the film, in the sense that as humans, we're just not very good at bridging that divide. You know, we are shaped by and informed by technology in certain ways, but not really able to keep up with it.
Oh, another great early scene that totally follows what you're saying is they make the discovery and then it's like, oh, you need to come to Washington, D.C. now. But they don't go to the Lansing airport or the Detroit airport. They're suddenly in the back of a C-130 military cargo plane. And if you'll recall, they're kind of like figuring out, like, where do we sit? How do we comport our bodies in this massive special airplane? I took note of that scene because it's an airport scene in a way. They're on the tarmac. They haven't taken off yet. And the reason they're on that particular plane is because their trip is urgent, but they also like don't have seats. And they're sort of like, what are we supposed to do? The human, the mere animal entities on this machine. And so I think it also sums up that contrast that you're talking about, or that friction.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very small inside of this massive cargo plane and kind of unwieldy. It's also a reminder of the, you know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the militarization of planes. I mean, I think airplanes have always, well, not always, but almost from the beginning, right, have been used as means of warfare. I feel like in a way that hovers in the background too.
Well, the flip side of that is the commercialization of space travel, which was kind of first and foremost a kind of military enterprise, or at least using a lot of that cultural energy and technologies. But we see now that there's this inversion where, like, well, space could be for passengers and for everyone or anyone. And that's you know, played out in Don't Look Up very clearly. First, you have that space shuttle and the rockets that are going to be weaponized. And then that is changed into the spacecraft as like the escape pod for humanity.
I feel like there's a little wink to Dr. Strangelove too with that airplane. I don't know if it's conscious or not, but people have talked about it as like a climate change Dr. Strangelove, which I don't know. Hold on a second. I had thoughts.
No, there's so much to talk about. I'm so glad you wanted to talk about this film because I've been itching to talk about it. And I should have watched that again instead of watching James Bond. But
there's a quote from Jack Handy early on in the movie, once they've discovered that this comet is coming to, you know, annihilate on Earth. And at first it's, "I want to die peacefully in my sleep like my grandfather." And then it gives you the rest of the quote, which is, "not screaming in terror like his passengers."
Right. I forgot about that. I'm so glad you reminded me, which is an air travel joke.
Right.
I think. Or maybe,
I don't know for sure, but that's what comes to mind for me anyway.
I mean, passengers, unless he's like a train conductor, but we don't typically, or a bus driver maybe.
Yeah.
But I think I think for multiple reasons, it's got to be air travel. For one of the reasons is because we have this aging population of pilots. You know, you have this amazing demographic shift where all these pilots are retiring right now. And the airlines are having a hard time getting young pilots because they, you know, young people don't really want that job. But for a while, I mean, in the kind of post-war era, this was like the job that you would get if you were a military pilot or you just love to fly. It doesn't have that same kind of cultural cachet. So I think that's also why that joke needs to be an air travel joke, because the grandfather is a pilot who dies at the, you know, in the cockpit. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. It's funny, though. I mean, to me, it's like an indication of the fact that this is, on some level, a comedy, right? And
yeah,
like, I mean, it's a horrible comedy, but it is, I mean, it's also like a, you know, speaks to the fantasy that we all have of kind of putting our head in the sand and, you know, yes, Earth is going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
I'm just going to pretend it's not happening. And
So, you know, the villain in the new Bond film, I'm so sorry to do this.
No, no.
The villain has this monologue toward the end where he says something to James Bond as they're like in the standoff. What's his name? Rami Malek, is that his name, I think? He says, humans want to be told what to do and then die without like knowing what's happening to them or something like that. And it was just really, it just relates to what you were saying about this kind of species-wide collective denialism and why it sort of functions the way it does, which is a very like bitter truth. And of course, this is like the bad guy saying it. Of course, James Bond is trying to prove that no, like we can rise above and be better. Anyway, the psychological aspects of Don't Look Up are really subtle and they work because of the comedy, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that makes me think about the failure of leadership, which is one of the themes of the movie, right? So you have the whole team and then the journalists who also fail in various ways. But I'm not sure that the film really is that invested in putting the blame on any individual so much as more of a kind of cultural failing. You know, social media obviously plays a really big role.
Yeah, that's why that technologist who's like the iPhone guru, that's why I wanted more out of that character, because it seems like if that movie really wants to point a strongest finger at someone, it would be a kind of Jeff Bezos or a Elon Musk.
Yeah,
even more so.
But
than
there's
like
a
the
sense
president.
In which we're kind of all implicated, right? Like the Jonah Hill character who's the chief of staff,
yeah.
In the very last shot, he's tweeting about the fact that it's the end of the world. And, you know, and there's that first appearance that they make on this like Good Morning America type show, and the Ariana Grande character gets a proposal from her boyfriend, and that gets many, many more tweets than the fact that, you know, the world is about to come to an end. And so it's kind of poking fun at all of us in that way.
It is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I felt like Don't Look Up, in a funny way, I mean, because it is so black and white in a way, comet hurtling towards the earth, you'd think that everybody would understand that. But it sort of deals with our failure as human beings to grapple with an existential threat, because it's almost antithetical to our way of being on some level, you know? And I think that's true about climate change. It's so hard to wrap our heads around, you know?
Yeah. And it seems to me like one of the most tangible ways to do that is when you cast it in terms of future generations. And yet that's something that the film wasn't something that was really dealt with so much. With climate change, you see that a lot more. And we see that with, of course, like Greta Thunberg and the youth, why the youth is so impassioned. But that too involves a different scale of thinking. One that it's hard for a lot of people to like make that leap.
Yeah. Well, like that Meryl Streep plays at one point, she says, you know, do you know how many doomsday meetings we have on a regular basis? And in a sense, she seems ridiculous in that scene because we know that this is a real threat. But on the other hand, we are kind of all saturated with these apocalyptic stories and so on, so that it's hard to separate fiction from reality on some level. You know, it's hard to kind of know what's what.
Actually, mentioning her, I mean, that makes me think too, the one time that the film pokes direct fun at our lack of like future thinking. I mean, at the end, she gets on the spaceship to go save the species and has literally forgotten her son. like forgotten to like take him along. And so that kind of like encapsulates that paradox where it's like, oh, well, we're going to save the species, but that doesn't mean actual people. That just means like the idea of the species.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love the way it pokes fun of that whole fantasy too, where they managed to survive in space for, what is it, like 26,000 years to land on a planet and then get eaten by some other creature.
Right. No, that was brilliant. Yeah.
That was funny. What do you think of that final scene of the dinner party?
Well, one thing I thought about it was that the Peter Isherwell character, who has been shown to be right about a lot because of all of his like data-driven research. Do you remember the time that he kind of interrogates Leonardo DiCaprio's character? He says, "We know everything about you. In fact, I know you're going to die alone." And you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is, you know, speechless. Dr. Mindy's very like uncomfortable with that. But then interestingly, like the film proves Peter Isherwell wrong and that they actually die having this dinner together with his family and his colleagues. And I thought that was actually really interesting. So the Peter Isherwell character is right in these other ways, like the way that the president dies. You know, and he's kind of almost right about the drone, you know, like he gets a lot of things right, but then there are these like really, really profound things that he gets wrong. And that's one of them, that actually Dr. Mindy dies together with people. And so that's like a kind of a subtle thing, but I thought that was a really important move to make.
Mm-hmm. I also felt like it sort of echoed the beginning again with that contrast between the kind of mundane, everyday kind of human things.
It also reminded me of like grocery shopping during the like early months of the pandemic when they were grocery shopping and he was like going on about the virtues of wild salmon versus farmed salmon. And the grocery store was just like looted basically. But he's like, no, we're going to get the wild salmon, you know? And it reminded me of like, oh yeah, I remember that feeling of like, you know, finding these little gems in these barren grocery stores.
Right. And also the steadfast belief we have that these kinds of decisions matter.
Right. But in that moment, it really mattered because it was like their last supper.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's real, it's this small talk that they have about like the store-bought apple pie and the fact that the one character actually really likes it.
It was like, in some ways, it was the most like meaningful, honest, like discourse that happened in the film.
In the whole course of the film. There's a real contrast, a real sort of stylistic contrast between that scene and most of the film.
Yeah.
And then there's that line that the Leonardo DiCaprio, the Dr. Mindy character has, which is, "We really did have everything, didn't we?" And I mean, maybe I'm a sap, but I confess that one did hit me.
Yeah.
And I think it's also conveying something with respect to climate change, because this situation is asking us to change our lives in various ways, but we're pretty spoiled. we really have a lot. And I don't know. Just ending on this note of gratitude too, I felt like there was something right about that. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I felt that way too. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but the production company behind that film is called Hyper Object Industry, which is a riff on Timothy Morton's writings on hyper objects and ecological thinking. And just for me, like knowing Tim really well and having worked with him at UC Davis and having him visit here several times in New Orleans, like it was gratifying for me to see like this kind of like high theory idea that has actually like worked its way into a blockbuster film. And I felt like that very humanistic kind of soft ending around the dinner table was, in a way, like that was very consistent with this kind of thinking about climate change, which isn't like, you know, nihilistic. And it's not like, it's actually not depressing. It's more like, whoa, let's like really pause and like, what do we care about? Who do we care about? And if these things are true, how do we do that justice? Mm. Which I think motivates like the kind of thinking and writing that's in Tim's books. And I can see why the film is kind of wanting to build on those ideas, even though it was like they're like exported from, you know, kind of like high environmental theory to Hollywood film.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, the more we talk about it, I feel like my takeaway from the film has to do with that humanism you know, with the like the moments mm-hmm. of humanism. And it doesn't shy away from making points when it wants to make points. You know, there are these images of the natural world, for instance, that crop up almost as if we're watching like an opera or something like that. And it's like
yeah.
giving a certain note as the world is about to be destroyed. You see the polar bear,
right.
you see a bee and so on. So that's ways in which it's kind of more overt about its message. But I do feel like that humanity, which is what settles after the chaos of the media and the politics mm-hmm. and the, you know, all the kind of circus of this mm-hmm. farce, I guess in that sense, you could say that that's the hopeful part of the film.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it does also come back to, you know, it's also, I think, worth noting that where do they end up? They end up back in Lansing, Michigan, which is where it began. And so it does have this kind of return to the local. But you can read that as sentimental or sappy, but I think there's something really strong about that. There's this like little kernel of happiness toward the end of that film, and it's back home.
If there are other movies you think we should discuss, clearly I have a lot of movies to see, send me an email to askwith, that's askuith, .intheweeds@gmail.com. Coming up, we might have some more on climate change, but I'm also working on a short series on mermaids. I'll be talking to author Lydia Millett about her book, Mermaids in Paradise. If you haven't read it, please do. It's pretty entertaining. And that's all I'll say for now. We'll be back soon.